everyone, and welcome all of you to Nikki Lyle Creative Presents with Industry Leaders, where today I'm joined by a very special guest, Forrest Young, who's Global Principal at Wolf Olins. Welcome, Forrest. Thank you so much for taking time today to spend with us. So would you mind just giving us a real quick synopsis about yourself?
Absolutely. So my name is Forrest Young, as Nikki mentioned, and I am Global Principal at Wolf Olins. We are roughly around 55 years old. We are founded both by a strategist and a designer, hence Wolf and Olins. And most people don't know this, but one of our first clients were the Beatles. So we actually created Apple Records. And so I think it really has been this almost a half century of really trying to have companies advocate on behalf of people. So that's really what kind of drives the kind of company ethos.
I had no idea you worked with the Beatles. How did I not know that?
We're the only company, I think, that's worked with all three Apples. So Apple Records, Apple, and New York City. We consider the Big Apple.
What point in your life did you decide you wanted to become a creative?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. You know, I think for a lot of people, it's very different. I think some people don't realize, you know, how much they're drawn to form. For me, it happened very young. My uncle taught me how to paint when I was around kind of three or four. And so my foray into making things and making forms started through painting. And I don't think, you know, design as a profession really entered my mind until I was maybe well out of undergraduate studies. It was something that I kind of stumbled upon through entering a competition that was, oddly enough, for a furniture design. But now I understand design and its greater kind of capacity to be able to adjust things and change things that you think need changing.
Yeah, okay. So after you graduated, how did you then pave the way and set your career towards becoming the designer that you are now and creative?
Yeah, and see, Nikki, most people don't know the story, so this is great that you're asking these questions. So when I graduated, my first inclination was I enjoy making things. I love my, you know, had a relationship to form that I've had since I was three or four. But I really wanted to give back in some capacity. And to me, it felt like, well, you're good at science and math. So, or maths, depending on where you are. And I thought, you know, I should just go back and become a doctor. So I actually was pre-med for quite a while. And I went back to school, took an aggressive chemistry course, and was all slated to study for the MCATs, which are the test preparations for becoming a medical student. And then I had a moment of pause. I think it was right around 9/11. And I thought, my goodness, you know, if I, you know, I was only going to live one more day, what would be the thing that I would want to be doing? And I really felt this urge to start making again and to do all the things that I had always wanted to do, but never really got around to it. And so I thought, what is the thing you're most afraid of doing? And so I said, well, in high school, I was terrified of like theater. Like theater was the last thing that I would have done. So I started studying acting, actually. And I was in Chicago. I had an acting coach. And it was during the process of studying acting and taking night classes in design that I entered a design competition that was from a fabrics corporation. And it was to order a giant roll of fabric and to make something with it and then send it back in. And so I ordered this roll of fabric came. I thought, oh my goodness, it was like enormous. I had no room for it. And so I made a little chair. And my favorite aspect of designing the chair was creating the poster for it. And I had to tell the story through a relationship of words and pictures. And this poster ended up winning the competition. It was an international design competition. So all of a sudden I thought to myself, my goodness, what did I do? I ordered this roll of fabric. Next thing I know, I'm an interior design magazine. What does this fork in the road mean? Should I study act? Should I keep going with acting? Should I do design? And so I decided to do both, which I don't recommend for everyone, but I thought that it'd be so difficult to try to do both of them that one of them was going to naturally cannibalize the other one. So I auditioned for Juilliard. I actually performed Molière for Michael Kahn, who taught many of the greats, the great actors. And I interviewed at Yale, and those were really the two programs that I was looking at. And I got into Yale, and I thought, okay, this must be a sign that I'm going to pursue design. And it was a three-year program, which meant that I had a year or two really understand the foundations of design, typography. And it was, of course, the storied program that Paul Rand taught in, all of the kind of the modernist greats, but also a lot of the great designers and educators of today, like Sheila de Bretville, et cetera. And so I felt like I had found my place.
That's so interesting, because it's not always this clear-cut, set path or journey to becoming a creative. There's so many different routes and where you can go about it, where you don't necessarily study at college and then at university and then fall into it. And I love that story, actually, of how you carved your own path, actually. And would you say that the background and your different experiences made you a better designer, because you've won so many like awards and accolades? And would you say that's what adds to kind of the magic formula of all these awards that you've won, perhaps?
I think so. I think a lot of times some of the most empathetic designers, the ones that bring a kind of a nuance to their form and their craft, come from very bizarre backgrounds. You know, they either are non-traditional designers or they came from adjacent places. They might have been filmmakers, et cetera. And they bring something different to the approach to form, whether it's movement, whether it's a kind of a kinesthetic awareness of the design, whether it's making forms with their bodies. I think for me, understanding both how the kind of left brain and right brain work and how to communicate, you know, a formal proposition to somebody who's incredibly analytical was one of those things that I felt like I had been studying this my whole life, you know, whether it was pre-med or, you know, studying the sciences. And so I feel like, I was able to then kind of switch hemispheres and be able to understand how a right brain concept could actually be reframed for kind of a left brain audience. And I think that that was a huge benefit for that trajectory.
Yeah, definitely. And so what was the career path from the different agencies you've worked at? So you've worked with some very prestigious agencies over the years, and then what led you to where you're at now with Wolf Olins?
Yeah, so the first place that I worked was actually in the Bahamas. So all of my classmates were dead set on going to New York City. You know, you have to go to New York City if you want to cut your teeth as a designer. And I thought, I don't think I want to go to New York City just yet. I think I have a lot of things just still to learn. I want more kind of intimate client relationships or to just go back to school. And so initially I was slated to go to the Jan van Eyck Academy, and I was going to study the future of the book for kind of a 2-year fellowship. And then I thought, I don't want to do that. But what am I going to do if I'm not going to New York? And so I talked to one of my classmates who's actually in the sculpture department. And he said, well, you know, I'm not going to New York. I'm going to the North Pole. I said, I'm sorry, what? You know, you're going to the North Pole? He said, yeah, I'm going to the North Pole. I'm working on a project where I'm going to, I've already cut out a 5-ton block of ice. I just need to figure out how to retrieve it from the North Pole and bring it down to the Bahamas. And I said, well, that sounds fantastic. I would love to help imagine the exhibition, if there needs to be a book that needs to be designed, a website, et cetera. And so we had an ongoing collaborative relationship. And that was really my first project after graduate school, was navigating the project that was essentially trying to locate a 5-ton block of ice in the North Pole, relocate it, and then design something around it using graphic design. And I so happened to just find myself in a couch surfing in the Bahamas. And I thought, well, what's next after this? Definitely not New York. And so I ended up working at a kind of digital design boutique advertising shop that was in Central Florida. And it was one of my classmates from graduate school. And I thought, well, it'd be very interesting to work alongside another one of my classmates. One was obviously a sculptor for the first project. This one is another one of my graphic design colleagues from the MFA program. And I thought it was so fascinating, because they tell you in design school, an earmuffs for anyone who works in advertising, don't work in advertising, because your typography is going to fall apart. You're not going to understand all the nuances of form, your own approach to form. But for me, I thought it was an incredible eye-opening learning experience about this world of media. I had no idea that, you know, advertising essentially is all about media placement. It's a media model. And if you understand how media works, you understand really kind of where the money is, and that branding, or, you know, a lot of the design boutiques are really a consultancy model where you're paying for team and time. And so for me, that was eye-opening, that literally you could almost throw in the creative for free, in advertising. And I thought, okay, this will be a very interesting laboratory for me to operate in and to try to figure out how to design within a much more of a rapid, style workflow. Advertising was moving so fast. that in order to have great typography, I had to learn how to do great typography very fast. I had to learn how to present to people who didn't have design as their topmost consideration, or even branding as their topmost consideration. And so it was a very kind of rough and tumble introduction to what I would, you know, say it would be my foray into branding. But I think it was really understanding where is the role of how to create something emblematic, you know, for a company, and to really realize how much, you know, the places and the context that it showed up, which was of course the media model, was incredibly important to how that story came to life. And so that was a place called Push. And then I had my own shop for a while. I moved to Austin, Texas, and I took on a bunch of clients there. And about 2 years after I was, I had moved to Austin, I ended up working for so many clients that ended up being either my old shop or in New York City. And I thought, well, you should just move to New York City because you keep going back and forth between Austin and New York City. So I talked to a lot of people in New York, and I really didn't know what type of shop I was going to work at. I was really smitten at the time by the work that Huge was doing, and I loved, you know, what Joe Stewart had done there. So I thought, okay, that's interesting. That's more of a digital shop. I looked at some of the traditional players like boutique design shops, you know, some of the places that my teachers had taught at or had founded as, you know, founding partners. But I found that the experience that I had when I was in Austin, I worked on a freelance project at Frog Design, was this space between kind of a product consideration, you know, how do you actually kind of make something and prototype something, and the branding consideration, what are these kind of high level attributes and stories and propositions and logos. But there was this kind of gray area that no one really seemed to be drawn to, and maybe it was too precarious, which is why. But it's, you know, kind of taking what we think of as traditional branding and how do you make it come to life, you know, in product. And I feel like there's this huge kind of Grand Canyon. There's this big divide about, you know, taking all these documents and almost feel like they're designed for, you know, the boardroom rather than for actual practitioners. But then you're within a kind of product consideration, you have a roadmap and you almost see these marketing documents and you go, oh my goodness, how is this going to inform a hover state or a button style? And so I sought out similar clients that I had overlapped with at Frog Design. I thought, what would be interesting to actually move across the same client that I had at Frog Design in branding. And so Interbrand had a specific account that was actually dedicated to these kind of larger, fast moving tech clients. And there were actually some client partner synergies between Frog Design and Interbrand. And so I moved over and I thought, my goodness, I hope I don't lose myself in this large, you know, agency structure now that I've been these very nimble places and had my own shop. But I found it to be incredibly eye-opening, both what design at scale requires in terms of how to really think about systems thinking, how to think about all the different people that touch and bring a kind of a brand experience to life. But also how technology was changing, how companies were thinking about themselves. You know, I think this was when everyone was trying to figure out what is their mobile presence or what is their even, you know, web 2.0 presence. And all of a sudden, you know, all these brick and mortar entities are starting to say, oh my goodness, I'm feeling a tremendous sense of urgency to be chasing what these tech clients are doing. And so in many ways, that was the best, you know, learning environment for me to see, oh, this is how branding is changing, how this kind of sum of all interactions are really becoming much more kind of technologically aware. So I was at Interbrand. And then I went to West. And West was this, at the time, was a very kind of top secret incubator of startups. And I thought, my goodness, this sounds, you know, so incredibly seductive. Allison Johnson was the former marketing lead at Apple. And I work with Steve Jobs on, you know, launching, you know, the iPhone and all of these amazing products. And at the time, she was incubating a lot of startups, trying to figure out how do you brand, you know, the next, she was actually working on Twitter with Jack Dorsey. How do you brand, how do you create a brand called Twitter? How do you create a brand, you know, Jawbone? How do you create a brand in Square? At the time, she had Impossible Foods as a client. And Jordan Crane, who was the one of the creative leads on the San Francisco side, ex-Wolf Olins, was incredibly persuasive. And he's like, you have to come join West because we're working with Impossible Foods. And there's nothing more exciting than, you know, making meat out of plants. And I thought, you're absolutely right. And so I jumped from Interbrand and joined Jordan and Allison at West. Was there for a short stint, And then ultimately wanted to take some of the learnings of startups and working with early stage companies and then go back to the kind of creative consultancy model. And that was my jump back to Wolf Olins, if that makes sense. And Wolf Olins had always been a place that I thought, my goodness, they do such daring and provocative work. They do the work that everyone wants to do, but no one can get away with. And I thought, I really want to get under the skin of this company and figure out how are they able to do some of those classic, you know, things like 2012 and, you know, Orange and some of these kind of almost iconoclastic works that now are heralded as these things that we kind of covet and look at with like kind of almost reverence. And that drew me back to Wolf Olins. And so I've been there ever since.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story there. And so what's Steve Jobs like to work with?
Yeah, I mean, that was obviously the real reason, right? I jumped to West was to get all the Steve Jobs stories, which I think every designer wants to know, like, what was it like to work with Steve Jobs? And I think the short answer was he was a perfectionist. And I think with being a perfectionist, he had incredibly high standards and was incredibly demanding, you know, towards his core team. And I think, you know, Allison may have said she got hired and fired four different times. And I think, you know, her approach was trying to take the best of what she learned from Steve and specifically creating excitement around something that the world hasn't seen before. Like for her, the iPhone was such a dramatic moment because it was like, people are holding this thing that's like a calculator, but it's a phone, but it's also a computer. And this is going to change the way we think about everything. What is the next version of that? And I think for her, she wanted to bottle that experience and translate that into a business model. And I thought, my goodness, that's exactly what I think what we all find to be so fascinating is people in some ways know exactly what they want, but sometimes they're surprised that there's something they wanted, but they didn't know that they wanted it. And I think that's always fascinating for designers in terms of either trying to create that persuasive argument or to try to kind of meet that need state where it is.
Yeah, I guess it's so interesting because I think I heard that with Steve Jobs, when he first released some of his products, he wrote all these very in-depth like manuals and it kind of bombed. But then he worked at, was it Pixar? And then he learned the art of storytelling. Is that right? And then he then created like a lifestyle and then he just went from releasing a long document with loads of technical stuff that no one cared about to suddenly one sentence selling an aspirational slogan and dream about his products.
Yeah, it's really a fantastic journey. And it's also interesting to say that, you know, he studied, you know, calligraphy at Reed, and he always think back that, you know, that initial, you know, immersive experience that he had with beautiful typography was something that he never really moved away from. And that was like really formative for him. I think it was also interesting that he spent, you know, a lot of time with Paul Rand, you know, with Next, and Susan Kerr, who was able to take from Apple to join him at Next. And so he worked with all these, you know, design, you know, kind of powerhouse, you know, figures. And it's fascinating to see how much Apple changed when he left, but then also when he came back and he brought, you know, Johnny Ive and this incredible heightened design sensitivity that Apple really was, you know, truly, you know, design led. And I think, you know, for designers, you know, you can't help but look at Apple as holding this kind of special place of reference because it's a thing you can usually point to for the most part and say, that was incredibly designed. There may be some parts of the experience that may be frustrating, but I think there's some aspect of, you know, design consideration being really important.
Yeah. And what about your own design style? Do you have a distinct style or a formula, or do you try to keep it quite fluid?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'd love to do, and I tried to write this down when I was in graduate school, like, what do you actually do as a designer? And I realized that what I enjoy doing the most is just a thing called shifting, which is taking something and doing some relatively minor move to something to try to have the most maximalist effect. And so it's like minimalism meets maximalism. It's that point where you can like tilt something and then all of a sudden become something completely different. Yeah. And I don't know if that's because I'm lazy or it's because I think those moves always feel so elegant when someone's able to do that one little move and all of a sudden you see something in a completely different light. I remember looking at the Pacific Southwest Airlines planes that used to, you know, go up and down the western seaboard of the United States. and they had smiles on them. And it was before planes really had these, you know, fantastic, you know, livery, you know, wraps and things like that, like, you know, the, you know, airlines like Southwest do. And I thought, who in their right mind would paint a smile on a plane? That's mad. And I remember looking out at this plane, and the plane is like smiling back at you and thinking, oh man, like, I didn't know that was design, but it was that ability to do one thing that completely transformed how you were thinking about your experience of being in the air. And so I would say that it is taking something, understanding all of its limitations, its vulnerabilities, its layered kind of complexity, and then looking at the thing to move or to shift that makes you see it in a different way. And you can kind of see that thread, you know, through a lot of work. You know, at Uber, it was the U frame. It was just pushing it back just so you saw a U that, you know, frames the, you know, the central subject. You know, Modern Fertility was really a story of, you know, two kind of vertical things that reminded me of the two founders and the M that's formed between their kind of connected partnership. And I think it really is a lot of times being inspired by the brief, but also the people that are bringing the brief to you. And I think in that way, all projects feel very very personable, but also incredibly intimate, in that you'll always have some notes of what happened in the room. Like, can you believe that we talked about that? And that actually got baked into the thing. But I think there always is something, and I would hope that my design is also somewhat telegraphic. I think I would definitely not say that my work is too obscure. I think I like to have work that has a degree of accessibility to people to be able to read into it. At the same time, I do think that there are usually is one understated move that does some type of shift.
Yeah, like speaking about like the understated moves, like with JKR and Domino's pizza, and how all of a sudden it just, you saw it and you're like, oh, it's been there all along. Just make it Domino's pizza, Domino's boxes, and the kind of sharing and the shifting, like you said, and it's just that design that people remember that really stands out. So is there a set way that you manage your clients when you work with them?
Yeah, so I always try to establish, you know, is the client relationship one of trust? Is it one of taste? And usually if I don't have taste or trust, that's usually when I flag the client and I'm like, this is probably not going to be a good journey. So I always tell young designers, if you're trying to figure out who to work for, when you talk to them in the first meeting, you have to assess taste, trust, or leave. Because if you don't have taste, then at least you can have trust and they can trust that you'll, you know, look after their best interest and bring it across the finish line. If they have taste, you can work with them as true collaborators, and you can kind of, you know, be, whether it's, you know, sharing files or sharing inspiration and mood boards. But if you don't have taste or trust, that's when you end up with, you know, well, I showed it to my friend and my friend didn't like it, and I showed it to so-and-so. And that's when you get people that start to get really jittery in that moment where you need them to have conviction. And so I think if you're really looking to create great work, you have to be able to have some type of structural bridge with the people you're working with. And I usually find that bridge happens either through taste or through trust.
Yeah, that's two really good points. What advice would you give to any junior creatives that are watching this at the moment about starting out in the industry?
I think one is know that you have a ton to learn, but also know that you probably have skills that are completely terrifying to people that are older than you are. I remember talking to a motion jury, and they were all kind of, they looked dejected, and I go, what's going on, guys? And they said, these kids are just so talented. And what they were talking about was that all the work that they were seeing, the actual practitioners, and they might've been, I think they were judging the, you know, kind of college university level. These kids have been editing in camera since they like had held a phone. They didn't know that they were called it editing. And you have people that are judging the work that, you know, first started editing when they were like 22, you know, when they first had access to an Avid suite at a production facility. And so it was this moment where, wow, everyone is getting so talented and they're not even aware of how talented they are. At the same time, I think that a lot of success is often the things that are these, you know, soft skills. They are understanding what I would call the Louis Armstrong silent note, which is the moments to not say something, the moments to say something, understanding when work is really kind of on the line. And I would say to remember, in addition to the TASE, trust, or leave, or the TTL shorthand, that there are three gates you have to operate to be successful. And they're not going to be apparent immediately when you start off. The first gate is you have to get your core team, the team that you're working on intimately to bring a project across the goal line. You have to bring them through the gate of being advocates for your work, because they need to bring enthusiasm, especially if you're not presenting it. They need to bring the enthusiasm of your project into the room, into a room that you may not be in. The second gate is understanding that the client then needs to understand the level of excitement, and they need to be persuaded that they can go back and tell the story of this phenomenal root in the room. But then the third gate is the gate in which neither yourself or any of your team is going to be present, because it is the client talking to their supervisor away from the whole consultancy, which means that you have to consider that third gate by giving some type of smart, encapsulated, transmissible story that they can then be the true hero of the project. And I think a lot of times younger people get discouraged because their team doesn't understand how great the project is or their approach was. But you have to understand how everyone is validating the work. Is it something that feels too obscure? Is it something that feels too juvenile? Is it something that feels this? You have to understand the criticisms you're going to hear from your team, overcome those, understand the likely criticisms that you're going to have from your client partner, and then ultimately understand the criticisms that your client partner is going to have with their supervisor, which oftentimes you're not going to ever encounter. And so those three gates are something that I always try to remind people of.
Yeah, and I guess with your work, you need to convert everyone into cheerleaders for your project and to be excited. And like you say, speaking about your idea, carrying it for you when you're not there still and pushing it for you. Do you have any stories of creative mistakes you've made? And if so, how have you overcome them?
Wow, there have been so many mistakes. I'm just trying to think of like which one would actually be one.
Like what you said about the Louis Armstrong thing about the silent note. And I've had some people say sometimes it's like when you're playing music like jazz, it's if you do a bad note, it's the second note that follows, which says if it's okay and if it flows still.
But yeah, no, absolutely. I would say there was a project that I worked on for the Yellow Pages, and I would say that it is still an identity system that I'm really proud of. And there was a moment where we had convinced the kind of the core team that we were going to interpret the Yellow Pages as anything yellow is your attempt to get something done, right? So it's a highlighted word, it's a yellow tool, it's the yellow sign of construction, you know, the intentional use of a small amount of yellow. And so we started off by saying that, you know, it would be a YP and then it would be underlined, and the YP logo would be kind of a black lowercase sans serif, and then we're going to take it out of this app launcher, which is very skeuomorphic, and we were going to make it something that just says YP and then underlined. And then a really brilliant strategist on my team, a guy named AJ Feld, started to talk about that if Yellow Pages was really going to take on, you know, some of these other, you know, kind of to-do like people or even the search engine like Google, that you had to think of Yellow Pages in the same way that you thought of, this is a task that I need to complete, which I thought was brilliant. I thought, oh my goodness. So it's kind of like, don't think of the Yellow Pages when you actually need to look something up. Like I need to get the number of a plumber, but actually think of them in the moment where you have that first inclination that you might need to fix your sink. You actually should see the logo. And so we came up with a version of it where it was YP, but the yellow was striking it out. Like it was just cutting through the YP. And of course, you know, we knew that it was going to feel way too aggressive and like it was kind of canceling itself out. But we thought, wow, everyone would be talking about, it's not even about Yellow Pages, it's about your ability to get something done. The fact that you can cross something out, the way that you're, you know, putting, you know, ticks on a calendar, you know, for days you're going to the gym. That actually, it's the company is not even about itself, it's all about you. And I thought, wow, that's a radical thing. And I feel like we probably could have sold that in if we had thought about some of the mechanics, but it kind of lived in too much of a kind of a space of controversy. And so I still think it's a fabulous system, but I think that was one that could have been, you know, truly epic.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Have you ever had anything else that's gone out the door that after an afterthought has been a bit of a mistake, which has been like a real error? Like, I've heard of some examples of where people have set things off to print and they've done like large prints or something with a typo, or they've seen something like on a billboard with a typo or something like that. Have you ever had anything like that happen in your career?
Yes, that's happened a lot. I've had issues with color. I think it's also difficult. You know, someone likened this to a controlled burn. How do you actually make mistakes on the job where you can learn by them, but not like take down the entire company? And I've had, you know, printing issues where we were printing yellow and the yellow just wasn't calibrated to the substrate. We hadn't thought about whether the substrate was really absorbent or whether it was not absorbent. And the yellow just came out either incredibly pale or oversaturated. And I thought, my goodness, it's going to be a very costly thing to have to figure out. But I remember that point saying, I am going to now learn and master, you know, doing a color print test, because I now realize if this had happened on any larger of a scale, oh, it would have been terrible. So I think some of the things are more those kind of implementation, you know, production things that I think a lot of times designers are removed from that production. Like, they do a lot of notional things, like this is the idea of what it's going to look like, and then somebody else kind of makes it happen. But the moments where you're actually working between creating something notional and then actually having it produced, I think a lot of times you have to sometimes learn the hard way some of those kind of printing mistakes. Also the value of spell checking when you've had a chance to rest and recuperate. I think doing QC when you can't really stare at your screen anymore, you're probably going to naturally miss, you know, words or some, you know, double spaces. So I think I've learned, you know, how to always build in time for, you know, proofreading or QCing or bringing in somebody who's bringing in that kind of production sensibility. I think some of the most egregious things, some of the things I kind of shudder at, are when I actually do a piece of writing and I will like start the sentence with the same word. That happened once and I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I let that go. And so I think it's just making sure that whatever you're crafting, whether it's words or whether it's, you know, something notional, whether it's something, you know, physically made, you allow yourself time to look at it again with a really critical eye.
Yeah, definitely. How are things over at Wolf-Olins at the moment? How have you been affected by the pandemic?
Well, it's fascinating. You know, I think in a lot of ways, I've enjoyed having much more informal meetings with clients, because I'm not in pajamas now, but you get a sense that everyone's kind of in like leisure wear and like they're on their couches and, you know, their dogs are walking through the camera or cats. And it feels like we're all just people, you know, trying to do things, which in the formalities of, you know, a conference room and the chilled water and all of those things, it starts to feel much more like business and feels much more transactional. I think the difficulties really are, you know, like Zoom and WebEx fatigue. I think it's a very real thing. I think we were all initially enamored by how we could connect to anyone, anywhere, and have these kind of back-to-back meetings without really moving and being able to do a whole host of other things. Like for me, like being able to see like my newborn on a much more regular basis. But I do think that it is fatiguing to have a same level of focus and intensity while looking into a screen for like 8 to 9 hours continuously. I think that the biggest danger is not only in kind of tuning out or zoning out, but also protecting that napkin sketch moment, that moment where somebody just has a really fragile idea and sometimes having to present it, like having to get on a Zoom call and to hold it up to the camera or to try to take a picture of it, put it into a deck, and then share that in Slack. It almost destroys that quality of it that in person would have been, It's kind of like this. And I think that's the moment that I'm trying to figure out, how do we do more of those napkin sketches so that we don't feel like distributed means that we're kind of doing these kind of rote solutions.
Yeah. Have you been hit work-wise at Wolf Olins by like the pandemic? Because different people have had different experiences with their clients. What's it been like for you over there?
Well, I think we're lucky in that we have a lot of tech clients, because I think tech clients are doing incredibly well in the pandemic, whether they have kind of captive audiences and they're seeing kind of phenomenal metrics. But I do miss, you know, a lot of our kind of cultural institution clients, a lot of, you know, we used to, I think, have a roster that felt much more balanced in terms of kind of tech and non-tech. So that's one of the things I think we're seeing, you know, here in the States, which is, you know, probably more significantly a larger proportion of tech briefs that are happening. But I do think, you know, we're lucky to have that's a kind of a buffer. But I do think, you know, many of us are thinking, well, what's on the other side of this pandemic? Are we still working distributively? What's the right type of, you know, kind of clientele that we actually want to say that we work on? Does it matter where they're located? Does it not matter at all? And so I think we've definitely been hit by, I think, the same adjustment that everyone's been forced to make, which is, I used to have a work-life balance that meant I had some kind of commute, or I had some way to kind of ritualistically separate work life from, you know, home life. Mm-hmm. And now I think a lot of people feeling that, like, oh, once I pick up my laptop, I'm working, and work starts to feel like it's maybe a little too close at times. And so I think those are things that we're really sensitive to, which is how to create more of that work-life balance for people, so it doesn't feel like work is always upon you. And we can be mindful of Zoom fatigue. As much as we are still sitting on the comfort of our own couches, it's still, you know, a lot. And how do we start to think of ways that we can start to the best of our ability, simulate what it's like to be in person, where ideas are flying around and things are being sketched? I don't think we've necessarily nailed it, but I think we've managed to succeed in making, in some cases, overcompensating for being distributed in terms of bringing that kind of energy into a meeting.
Yeah, definitely. It has been so, there's something lovely about this human experience that we've all shared together, where suddenly you're invited into people's homes and you're seeing their home environments. And like you say, someone's dog like walking through, or hearing someone's kid have a meltdown in the background, and it's stripped away all that kind of corporate formula before, like you say, with the water and the meeting rooms. But how do you think this is going to affect design going forwards with the pandemic and the kind of work that will be created?
It's fascinating to see the people who have, I would say, just a kind of the discipline to keep making stuff. I think, you know, I was just on a webinar with Zach Lieberman. He's somebody who I think everyone follows on Instagram or on Twitter. And it's amazing to see how much he produces, like, daily. Like, you can count on seeing another amazing thing tomorrow morning when you wake up. It's like, what did Zach Lieberman make? And I think that's a phenomenal thing, that it's so important to keep doing whatever gives you that sense of staying connected, whether it's making something and sharing. I also think that you don't have to make anything if you don't feel like it. But I do think that, that's been something that I've been very mindful of. And I think what it's shown, or how it's translated to your question, is that it feels like static type is almost like a thing of the past. Like, it almost seems impossible to imagine, like, a word mark that wouldn't move. Like, it was a certain point where I think you had, like, certain shops that did, you know, like Wolf Olins maybe, that did, like, dynamic word marks, or, you know, avatars. And that was kind of like, well, that's like Wolf Olins. They always do moving stuff. But now it feels like motion and having a time-based sensibility is almost table stakes.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because we are kind of this captive audience. We're all kind of in our various, you know, shelters, you know, looking at screens. But there's much more of a sense of dynamism to the work that I'm seeing. That's maybe an offshoot of the pandemic. I think it was also something that was probably happening, but has maybe escalated now that we've had more screen time. And I think blurring the lines between graphic design and other design disciplines. So I'm seeing a lot more times where sonic identity or haptic identity is brought into the conversation, you know, by clients. Usually that's something that we would suggest and say, well, have you thought about how it sounds or how it moves or how it feels? And that's almost being brought to the table now, because I think everything does feel very multi-sensory. Or how can we make things as captivating or more captivating, you know, than the news that shows, you know, these states are spiking with coronavirus. Like everything feels like it's this kind of attention erosion, and design has to compete in many ways with where your attention is going.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a fair point you said about if people are still creating in this time, and if people have been furloughed, it's like, well, have you been chilling or upskilling? You know, who are the people that have been trying to conquer Netflix, and who's actually thought, okay, I'm being paid 80% of my salary, but I'm going to learn After Effects, or I'm going to delve into this, or I'm going to delve into that, and I'm going to keep creating here and creating there. It is difficult because of the pandemic. It's quite a mental, everyone's very emotionally loaded right now with going through all of this. So it's that fine balance between appropriate rest and self-care and to keep creating as well. And I think that's one of the things quite interesting is perhaps in the future when people are interviewing people, that might be one of the main questions. So what were you doing during the pandemic? How were you spending that time? And if you've managed to delve into a subject matter that you love, that then adds to your craft as a creative, what does that look like as well? So what do you like to see when you're hiring for your team in a creative? What really stands out to you?
Yeah, and I also just think, you know, I've been moved by how engaged so many designers have become with all the things that are happening relative to, you know, like Black Lives Matter, or to some of the things that are underpinning, at least how we're experiencing the pandemic here, that I think are exposing, you know, a lot of, you know, fault lines. So I think there is kind of like an awakened consciousness that I'm seeing among a lot of designers that I think is incredibly commendable. I also think that this has been very taxing on designers. And I think, you know, as also being an educator, you know, being mindful that, you know, people need to do whatever they need to do to, you know, to truly take care of themselves. And I think that, you know, designers tend to be, you know, probably a little bit further on the spectrum in terms of, you know, whether it's depression or whether it's, you know, certain kind of insecurities. And I think that that's something we don't really talk about. And I think that, you know, hopefully we'll encourage just more forums to be able to talk about self-care as much as we're talking about, you know, kind of the artifacts. I think one of the things that I always try to, you know, investigate is, what is somebody curious about? And have they been authentically curious about something, or kind of optically curious about something? Well, I'm curious about this because it seems like everybody else is curious about the same thing. Or are they truly bizarrely fascinated by something? And can they manifest that curiosity into form? And I think for me, those are the people that stand out, the people that are, that have the conviction about their curiosities, to follow those curiosities to a level of depth, and then to have that inform the things that they make. That seems to be the sweet spot.
Yeah. That's a really common theme from the industry leaders events, actually. It's lots of people say that we can teach skills, we can send you on courses for skills that you need, but what are your ideas? What's your experience as a being in this world? What fascinates you, and what are you absorbing that you then want to create, basically, and narratives that you want to produce and design? And I think in regards to the pandemic, I never thought there'd be anything in this world that would stop the wheels of capitalism and production. But actually, lives have mattered enough. The survival of the human race has mattered enough for lockdown. And I think when we philosophize that lives matter, well, we're like, okay, Black lives matter, trans lives matter, everyone's lives matter. And how can we build this new world post-pandemic where everybody is given a fair shot and an opportunity in this world, which I think has been quite interesting to see and so important as well as creatives and how we can keep pushing that forwards. What do you look for in a portfolio? What kind of work do you recommend to showcase to possibly get the chance for an interview?
It's a great question, and one that I think, you know, should be asked more. It's a fairly straightforward question, but I think the thing that it's important to remember is usually the idea that inspires, you know, the next, you know, 2012 or whatnot is a fairly bizarre idea. It's usually an idea that doesn't look like an idea that you would recommend to someone. And I tend to find that those ideas are representative, they're represented in a portfolio where somebody is doing some type of self-initiated project. And so I think in a lot of portfolios, I would say, give yourself your own brief if it's possible to follow something that you're truly passionate about. And you have complete control over how something is photographed, the typeface that you're going to use to describe this, the words and the literature that you're using to reference maybe the thing or your own writing, the form factor, is it screen-based or is it, you know, a physical book? Is it something that's virtual and it's a physical book that's a 3D render and you'll never actually touch the book? All those things speak volumes towards what are the decisions that you would make in a vacuum? What are the decisions you would make if you didn't have, you know, kind of the client constraints of, well, it has to be a serif typeface, or, well, it has to be blue, and it has to be this. And I think self-initiated work is one of those things that I always find to be rewarding going through them, because it truly shows this is what this designer, this is how they think, and this is what they will do if left to their own devices. And it may be bizarre, but that may be also a beautiful type of bizarre. And I think a lot of times that work is missing because people start to say, well, they do, you know, like corporate branding. And so it has to feel like, you know, it's a corporate-like object. I think it's getting very hard to look at portfolios now that everyone's kind of using the same tools and is kind of like live surfacing, you know, all their apps. It almost feels like it's very hard to separate from somebody who's very young and entering their profession to somebody who is still using the same tools, like their work starts to feel oddly similar. And yeah. So I think the self-initiated work is very helpful in terms of showing kind of how you think. But also, yeah, feel free if there are some things that are adjacent to kind of traditional design, but to showcase not only how you think, but maybe how you're a systems thinker, how you can understand how one idea can manifest across a bunch of different form factors or contexts. Because I think that's really at the underpinning of what successful branding is that type of idea that inspires a system.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. I'm a big advocate for side hustles. And what's great about those is it's not the fee earning work that's the bread and butter client work that pays the bills. It's what do you want to do as a creative, and how would you manage it, and how would you hustle? And so a question out of interest, what does your day-to-day job look like when you get to the level of global principal?
Yeah, well, I mean, I try to still operate as flat as possible. You know, I still, you know, have a sketchbook and I still wake up and, you know, will write and scribble notes and ideas and drawings. And I think it's, you know, for me, I think, and this is speaking for myself, I think it's dangerous when you're too removed from craft. And I understand that, you know, somebody had this great analogy that a creative director is sitting shotgun in a car that is being driven by, you know, a senior designer. And the creative director is looking at the senior designer and or the, you know, kind of the junior designer. And they're going, I hope they know how to drive and I hope they can keep this car on the road, but I'm sitting in shotgun, so I can't really steer the car, but my job is to supervise and to give them feedback on you're too close to the right, you're too close to the left. And then the ECD, like global principal like person, is in the trunk of the car and they're texting with the creative director who's riding shotgun. And they're just like feeling the bump of the road. And they're like, well, we could be going off a cliff any moment. And it's this kind of, you know, complete detachment from the work. And I've always kind of tried to fight that a little bit and to try to be a little bit more present, either in the idea creation, the conversations around the work. So I think my day might look like I wake up, I go for a walk with my baby around the neighborhood, come back in, probably write some notes and also draw something. I try to write emails in the morning because I tend to find that's the only time that I really have to be truly on and to focus on what somebody has asked in an email. And then I think it is just welcoming in the day. And I'm lucky enough that my days tend to be quite varied in terms of what is escalating, what's urgent, is there a pitch, is there something that is an ongoing relationship? So I think, yeah, that's kind of the general DNA of the day.
What do you look for in your more senior designers at Warfolins? And what is the design process like at Warfolins?
So I think the design process is probably maybe something that's a little bit different at Warfolins. And I think at our best, and you know, we don't always, you know, hit this mark, but I think we try to honor, you know, the founding ethos, of Wally Olins and Michael Wolff, which is, you know, always have a strategist and designer, you know, together in the same room. And it's not always easier. And a lot of times it's, you know, two big opinions that are in the same room, kind of talking about what's being, kind of who's going to win in this tug of war. But I do think that design usually starts much further upstream, Wolff Olins, where designers are there at the kickoff. They're understanding how an idea starts to take form and it starts to become part of a value proposition. Like, why should people care about what this brand has to offer? Where does this show up? What type of audiences need to be won over? And I think the benefit of that is the designer starts to understand, you know, how she or he can then craft a compelling story, because you start to understand the context that these audiences will need to be registering. You start to understand even the words that you might typeset in the typeface that you choose. And I think, Wolff Olins, I think, you know, the amount of kind of Wolff Olins creative directors that have gone on to do amazing things, I think speaks to the fact that they're able to operate a little bit further upstream to understand strategically how there is not only persuasive argument, but what is the underpinning of the business strategy? And then how does it translate into kind of creating a compelling presence? And so I think a lot of times designers that are coming from other shops are used to saying, oh, okay, it's gotta be a logo. You have, you know, three roots, different colors, make a glossy one, make a matte version, make a this. And it's very much like a kind of a production exercise. And I think that we try to challenge designers and strategists to work together a little bit further upstream. I think sometimes that can be bumpy, but I think a lot of times it leads to much, much better work. I mean, 2012 is, you know, a case in point.
Yeah, definitely. So someone said, thanks for a great talk. As someone who comes from the client service side of the industry, I'd be keen to hear your take on what the best client services individuals at Warfolins bring to the role above others. And one other quick question is, you have a well-stocked bookshelf on your left. Are there any books you'd recommend, branding, design, or otherwise? So that's quite a few questions I've thrown at you there.
No, it's great. I actually have, I'll show you the books that I am looking at right now. So these are the two books that are within earshot. So I'm looking at two. So one is looking at Nobody Knows My Name by James Baldwin, but there's this book called Kindred, who's written by Octavia Butler. And I've been thinking a lot about time travel, and I was actually talking to an amazing educator who teaches at OCAD, Dean Dory Tunstall. And she talks a lot about how important, you know, Black speculative fiction and science fiction authors written by people of color have been to her. And when I think about time travel, it's very fascinating to think about what if the underpinnings of some of these brand decisions have been made from, you know, from like BIPOC, you know, participants and contributors. Like, would we be looking at a world that's much different? Would we still be looking at the same type of flying car prototypes? Would Star Wars have looked the way that it did? And so that's incredibly fascinating to me. And so I think a lot of my nearby bookshelf is actually looking at a lot of ways in which people have talked about imagining different futures that might be different ways to approach how we're designing something that lies ahead. And I think to your other question about client services, I think that this is probably the most underrated discipline. I think client services, you know, program management, project management, all whoever is facilitating the kind of the project as an organism, because I do think that it's, you know, project is dynamic. It's all these living, breathing people that are highly opinionated, all that have different relationships to deadlines and time and procrastination and type A and type B, and how to look at this organism that is the project or the program, how to safely navigate this organism ahead. So what are the levers by which you can start to create momentum? And how does that momentum lead towards a set of inevitability that you're going to reach some enviable target? And then how do you bring everybody else along? So it becomes this kind of snowball. And I tend to find this is incredibly challenging position. It's one where you would have to understand the psychological levers of all the participants, understand where the kind of client partner is seeing and how they're framing success for themselves, which a lot of times is framing success for their bosses. And then understanding all these different relationships to time and how you can start to frame time differently for people that have different relationships to it. So I think it's no short order. It's a really high bar. And I think that there's really a few people that I work with that I would say have managed to do all of those things. But when I have worked with those people, I would take them over anyone. Those would be the MVPs, truly, because they can understand how to work with different personality types, client side and also team wise, and bring them towards some type of alignment and then, you know, achieve some type of breakthrough momentum.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I'm very aware of time, and I know you're busy, Forrest. So we'll start wrapping this talk up here, and I'll let you go. But thank you again so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And it's been amazing to have you as a special guest as well for this talk. And thank you everyone that's joined us as well. Lots of really great advice and sort of insight there. If there was like one soundbite or thing that you wanted to say, is it like a top tip or something for creators at the moment for them to take away today? Is there any like pearl of wisdom or advice you'd give?
I would say design what you love. And then if you don't know what you love, then that is your first objective, is to find what that is.
Yeah. Okay. Really good advice. But yeah, thanks again, Forrest. Really appreciate it. And take care and good luck with everything.
Thanks so much, Nikki.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everyone.